Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
That Twitter IPO is not going to happen all by itself, you know. So today on the program, how a market gets made. Also, rising housing prices for good and for bad. And Amazon comes to television. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the studios of WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Kai Rizdahl, and this is the Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 6th of November. And it's tempting to say it's all over, but the shouting for the Twitter IPO. Bankers are nickel and diming their way to the final offering price. Everybody who's going to get early shares already knows who they are, lucky sons of guns. But the true indication of the company's value will come when trading starts tomorrow morning. And you might think that with computer algorithms and high-frequency trading, that's when the machines are going to take over, right? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports the most important part of Twitter's IPO will actually be done by a real live human being.
When a company first starts selling stock, figuring out how to get the share price right can be tricky. Set the price too low, demand overheats, and supply gets strained. Set the price too high, and demand falls off. That's where the designated market maker comes in. He or she gets busy before the bell, fielding calls from buyers and sellers about what the opening share price should be. James Angel is a finance professor at Georgetown University. He watched designated market makers in action during the LinkedIn IPO.
They would be calling out the various prices at which they thought it was going to open, and eventually they figured out where the price was going to open, and then they had the opening trade, and then the computers took over.
Computers do largely dominate stock trades, but human judgment is still crucial. Matthew Cheslock is a designated market maker for Virtu Financial.
The human element is there to backstop anything that may happen. We trade in milliseconds now, so it's hard to believe that the human can react that fast, but we're able to do it because of our experiences down here. Most of the people down here have been down here many years.
Cheslock's been on the floor for 20. Once the human has handed trading off to the machines, the designated market maker's role isn't over. Gary Schilling is an investment economist. He compares the market maker to a traffic cop who keeps trades running smoothly.
If nobody else wants to buy, they're supposed to be buying. If nobody else wants to sell, they're supposed to be selling. But they also were supposed to be, as I say, the last troops in times of real duress.
For instance, buying during a big sell-off to help stabilize the price, or selling during a surge in demand to make sure shares are available. In general, making sure the price is right. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
All right, moving on. Another day, another White House pushback on health care. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius spent the morning up on Capitol Hill answering questions from senators this time. President Obama went to Dallas for some events in which he thanked a group of people who have arguably the toughest job in health care reform right now. The folks who are helping consumers sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act. Navigators, they're called. They have had to, shall we say, adapt to the well-known troubles of the registration process. So from the Marketplace Health Desk here at WHYY, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein caught up with some navigators over in Camden, New Jersey, right nearby.
Since the exchanges opened on October 1st, Tony Cohn's been in overdrive.
It has been crazy here. I mean, if you can see the computer screen from where you're sitting and all the appointments we have, our days are just packed, running around, going here, going there, seeing patients. It's been nuts.
Cohen, who works for the Community Health Clinic Project Hope, is one of a handful of navigators in Camden trying to sign up people who are eligible for health care. She's been to churches, farmers markets, housing projects. Tomorrow, she's hitting local businesses in one of Camden's tent cities of homeless people. Because healthcare.gov isn't an option, navigators are resorting to paper applications. It's straightforward, but Cohen says she's worried.
Biggest concern I have of the past 5 weeks is that the people that had filled out applications had not heard anything back yet.
One reason, paper applications must be run through the same web portal as the online ones. 1 month in, less than 7% of the city's residents who are eligible under Obamacare have begun the enrollment process. Maura Collins Grew with New Jersey Citizens Action says there's a workaround. Have people eligible for Medicaid apply directly at that site.
because we discovered it was a way for people to enroll now while we await the glitches being worked out with healthcare.gov.
Collinsgrew says more than a third of the state's uninsured qualify for Medicaid now that the program's being expanded. Whether they know about it is another story.
America is not fully versed yet on the Affordable Care Act.
Karen Politz is a health policy analyst with Kaiser Family Foundation. She says as federal officials scramble to get healthcare.gov off the ground, navigators are doing some good old-fashioned education.
You know, a lot of people who are uninsured have had years of really unhappy history and have given up on it. And it doesn't even occur to them that maybe it'll work completely differently now.
Politz says all the technical problems with the website have depressed enrollment, but she points to Kentucky, whose exchange is working well, as proof that when things work, people are willing to sign up. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, two indices up, one index down. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Housing prices are up, which would seem to be good news for the economy. At least, that's the way rising home prices are traditionally played. But stop and think about that for just a second, because for pretty much anything else, groceries, gas prices, clothing, or appliances, the price of a product going up would definitely not be such welcome news. Marketplace's David Weinberg has more on the upside and the downsides of home prices on the rise.
For decades, housing prices have been rising faster than incomes. As a result, there's been a decline in the number of houses that are affordable to the average family. And even the families that can afford to buy a house are paying more.
I wanted to visit a city where this is playing out, and San Luis Obispo seemed like an ideal place. San Luis is on the central coast of California, about halfway between Los Angeles and San Francisco. And the night I was there, it was easy to see why people want to live here. One of the downtown streets was closed for a farmer's market. A street band played outside the Victoria's Secret, and everything had a soft glow from the lights strung in the trees. Not only is it beautiful here, there are good jobs. The median income is about $71,000, well above the national average.
The largest employer here is the state of California. That's with employees in two state penitentiaries, and then we also have Cal Poly, our university.
After the government sector is tourism and then agriculture, grapes for the blossoming wine industry.
Brad Taunt is one of the first people I sought out in San Luis. He's been a mortgage lender here for 27 years. I presented him with an imaginary family making the median household income of San Luis and asked him what kind of loan that family could get.
That particular buyer could find a house for about $356,000.
I then packed my imaginary family and its new loan into the car and drove over to real estate agent Monica King. I asked her to show me just what that $356,000 would buy.
These pictures are wonderful compared to what it looks like in person.
She pulled up some listings in her office.
It's older, built in 1963. It's 1,585 square feet. It does have new carpet, but it's really funky.
Then came the bad news. This was the cheapest house she had, and it was $475,000. She said there were no single-family houses that didn't need significant repairs available for $356,000. My imaginary family was crushed.
So more than half of the population in San Luis couldn't afford the cheapest house. So what are their options? Well, for most of them, they rent or they buy houses outside of the city in other parts of the county.
We never imagined in a million years that we would be able to afford a house.
Risa Brown and her husband Martin came to Brad Taunt over a year ago to get a mortgage loan. They were about to have a baby and wanted more space than they had in their rented condo. Together, they still made below the median income. I visited them in their new home.
Oh, I have a handyman business. Risa and her dad run a property management business, and so I do a lot of work for them. Probably 95% of my work is through them.
But the Browns were able to buy.
We paid $316 for this place. It's over 1,500 square feet, three bedrooms, two car garage on a quarter acre lot.
Their house is 20 miles north of San Luis in the town of Atascadero. Their new location means a half hour commute into San Luis, and they spend about half of their monthly income on their mortgage payment. Just a generation ago, that was unheard of, says Taunt.
Back then, income to debt ratios were 28 and 36%, meaning of your gross income, you could have 28% of your income going towards your housing expense.
Or you could spend that 36% on your mortgage and your debts, including student loans, credit cards, and any other debt. Today, it's common for families to spend half their income on their mortgage payment. This means cutting spending on everything from eating out to fewer vacations or less rainy day and retirement saving. And as families spend more on housing, they're making less. Eric Franks is an analyst with John Burns Real Estate Consulting.
Incomes, surprisingly, when you adjust them for inflation, have been declining since about 1999, which is pretty startling. So the purchasing power is actually 10% less than it was about 13 years ago.
The day after I left San Luis Obispo, I got a call from Brad Taunt. He wanted to emphasize that even with the challenges facing first-time buyers, this is a great time to buy if you can afford it. Interest rates are still low and housing prices are on the rise. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
We've got a cool new online interactive that'll add to this story. It's called Income Upshot, and it can help predict whether you're more likely to be a renter than an owner. You can check it out at marketplace.org. Coming up, introducing Marvel's first Muslim superhero.
Already it's getting a lot of buzz. I mean, I've seen people sharing items about it on Facebook and Twitter who I wouldn't normally expect to think about comic books at all.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials climbed 128 points this Wednesday. That is 0.8%, closed at 15,746. The NASDAQ gave up 7 points, about 0.2%, 3931 there. The S&P 500 added 7 points, 0.4%. Closed at 1770. Microsoft moved up 4% after reports that it has narrowed the field of candidates to replace its CEO and could make a choice soon. It's an interesting list. Ford CEO Alan Mulally and Nokia's Stephen Elop are reported to be on the shortlist. Some investors hope a new chief executive there might sell off money losers Xbox and Bing. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note, well, it fell to 2.64%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases its first estimate for gross domestic product for the third quarter. Chain stores are slated to report October sales. You're part of that figure if you purchased a new Halloween costume. And guys, grab a spatula. It's National Men Make Dinner Day. I know some of you do this on a regular basis. So awesome. For the rest of you, hire someone to clean the kitchen when it's all over, and don't forget the wine. I'm Michelle Filippi.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Commodity Futures Trading Commission, the CFTC for short, is part of the cornucopia of federal regulatory agencies in Washington. It's responsible for the safe and orderly operation of the markets in derivatives, bets, essentially, on what's going to happen in everything from interest rates to, I don't know, pork belly prices. The CFTC isn't exactly a huge government operation, but it is responsible for an enormous market on the order of trillions of dollars. And as Marketplace's David Gura reports, its leadership ranks are about to shrink a bit.
At a CFTC meeting yesterday, Commissioner Bart Chilton made an announcement.
Some of you may recall the old Etta James song, At Last.
You know the one.
At last.
Chilton's a regulator with a penchant for peppering speeches and statements with all kinds of allusions.
Today, at last, I'm pleased to say I'll be saying bio con Dios, my comrades.
The commission is already down one member, and its chairman's term is up at the end of this year. Jeffrey Manns is a law professor at George Washington University who says the regulator's job changed dramatically a couple of years ago.
One could say that the CFTC went from being a minnow into being a whale in terms of regulation in the wake of the Dodd-Frank Act.
Michael Barr helped write that law. Now he teaches at Michigan. Barr says the CFTC's new role is key. Derivatives were unregulated, and he says that led to the financial crisis.
It's a huge undertaking. It's absolutely core to reform, and it is a fundamental shift, a transformation from the past.
And one that, according to Frank Edwards, is being done on a small budget. Edwards is a professor at Columbia Business School. Is the CFTC equipped, in your estimation, to handle this new role?
No, not really.
The administration has asked Congress to give regulators more money. So far, that hasn't happened. Now it'll have to do something that may be even harder: get lawmakers to approve three nominees to fill three CFTC vacancies. In Washington, I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
All right, stop me if you've heard this one before, okay? Government attempts major upgrades to a service that people depend on and that everybody is required to join. But the online sign-up process is buggy, to say the least, and there is no shortage of other rude surprises. You're thinking healthcare. I know you are. But the truth is that you haven't heard this particular one before, unless you live in Chicago, where public transportation snafus have been front page news. The city's transit system rolled out a new payment platform this fall. Think Obamacare on a bus. Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the story.
About 2 weeks ago, Bob Fioretti got a courtesy call about his payment card for the Chicago Transit Authority's new farebox system. He hadn't activated it. Had he gotten an email with his temporary password? No, he hadn't. Thanks. Fioretti knew his old card was going to expire in a few weeks.
I said, I better get this card activated one way or the other.
But that email never showed up, and the website for the new system, which is called Ventra, was a mess. He called the helpline.
It rings, and then I was put on hold for 45 minutes.
Eventually, he hung up. He called a couple more times over the next few days. Same result. And here's where some Chicagoans might call their city council representative. We call them aldermen here, and they function as neighborhood fixers. Yeah, except Fioretti is an alderman. The Ventra system opened for business in early September, and the old payment systems were scheduled to shut down starting in mid-November. But 2 months in, the cards don't always work. When they do, riders complain they're sometimes double-charged. And then there's the helpline. Last week, the transit union head demanded that the CTA hold off on the transition till the kinks got worked out. He said his members were already getting cussed out by enough angry riders. Yesterday, CTA President Forrest Claypool issued a simple apology.
The bottom line is that too many of our customers are confused and frustrated, and that's our fault.
He also said that, yes, they'll wait to shut down the old payment system till the new one is fixed, including the helpline. And the contractor behind the system won't get a nickel till it happens. So did the city just pick the wrong contractor? Well, Cubic Transportation Systems has some pretty good credits. New York City, Washington, D.C., London. Joseph Schwederman teaches transit and urban policy at DePaul University in Chicago. He thinks part of the problem may be Ventra's all-or-nothing setup.
In a lot of cities, the stakes are less. Like in Washington, D.C., you can always buy the paper card and the smart card's a bonus.
The bigger mistake may have been trying to go too fast.
It could have been, this is a year rollout, everybody relax, you got time to, you know, hear from your friends how it works.
Instead, CTA tried to force everyone to be an early adopter, which doesn't describe your average Chicago strap hanger.
Their whole rhythm's thrown out of whack, and they're saying, why?
Plus, having a smart card system isn't new here.
We've had a card for a while. It's called the Chicago card.
The new card will offer more features, but the old one actually works today. Meanwhile, Bob Fioretti says he still hasn't gotten the email with his password. But in Chicago fashion, he knows a guy, the chairman of the city council's transportation committee. Fioretti says he hopes they can start having hearings later this month. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
If you find yourself becoming dissatisfied with the offerings from regular television producers, either the broadcast networks or cable and online, allow me to suggest a somewhat out-of-the-box alternative: Amazon. Yes, they've got an Amazon Prime video service, but that's other people's stuff. The company announced this week it's going to start offering its own original content. The first one, Alpha House, premieres November the 15th to Amazon Prime members, and therein lies the rub. Meredith Blake covers television for the Los Angeles Times. Meredith, good to talk to you.
You too.
Why does Amazon need this? I mean, they're not the original content people.
Right. I don't know that I'd say that they need it, but I'd say that they can certainly use some more subscribers to Amazon Prime. I think the report is that they have 11 million subscribers,
mm-hmm.
and that's a lot less than how many people use Amazon.
So they're using this to get people to Amazon Prime, which is the shopping service and all of that.
That's right, yes, in which you can get free two-day shipping and buy pretty much anything.
And I confess, and I have said this before on the show, I am a proud Amazon Prime member. It works. Uh-huh. I shop there a lot. But I don't know, if I were not an Amazon Prime person, whether this would get me to sign up. Do you think it's going to work?
I think it will work for some people. I mean, if you're the kind of person who I think there's a barrier to entry with Amazon Prime. I think some people think $79 a year. I don't buy that much from Amazon.
Yeah.
But if you can get that and you can get access to their library of licensed content, which is a huge number of films and TV shows, plus a new funny show starring John Goodman,
right,
maybe that'll be the tipping point for you.
Let's talk about this cast. It's got Goodman and a whole bunch of big names in it.
Yes. It has Mark Consuelos, who's playing sort of a Marco Rubio-type character. It also has Amy Sedaris and Wanda Sykes, a lot of very well-known comedy actors who have a built-in fan base.
And this is just the first one. Alpha House is the first one, and for some reason they call it the second one Betas, whatever.
Betas,
and
that's
I don't know
right.
what their thing is with the Greek alphabet.
I know.
What do you suppose the conversation was like between Amazon Studios and these person's agents when they said, listen, we're going to do some original content?
I think people's attitudes towards that are changing really rapidly. I mean, I think with Netflix, you know, and House of Cards, they got huge A-list talent attracted to that. They got a ton of awards recognition this year.
Because it was great. I mean, you know, their stuff was really good.
Yeah, and I think the kind of resistance to that, the snobbery, if you want to call it that, is quickly fading. I think, you know, you've seen this with TV in general. Now it's become cooler to be on TV than to be in the movies.
Yep.
And I think
which is annoying all the TV actors, by
exactly.
the way.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I think that's changing with these web outlets, too.
If, though, you are Reed Hastings at Netflix or somebody running HBO or any of the biggies, are you a little uptight about this? You a little nervous?
I think maybe you're a little nervous, but I think we have to remember that we don't know if these shows are any good yet. You know, we don't know if they're going to get the kind of acclaim that things like House of Cards and Orange is the New Black and then, you know, shows that HBO has been doing for 20 years that have gotten these kind of awards.
One thing we should point out is that they are not doing the binge-watching model of Orange is the New Black. They're going to release the first, three, and then they're going to dribble it out week by week like conventional TV.
That's right, yes. Three at once so that anyone can watch them, and then after that you have to subscribe and watch week to week, which is more of a traditional TV model.
Amazon is known for entering a space and then, not viciously, but with a determined mindset, driving everybody else out of that space. Do you think that's what they're going to do here, or is this truly just a thing they're doing for Amazon Prime?
I think it's hard to tell. I think if these two shows do well, I would be willing to bet that they push way more aggressively in terms of getting A-list talent attached, in terms of expanding their catalog of back titles that they have available to, you know, not necessarily original content, but the old shows and old movies. And they'll get more aggressive about that. I think it's sort of a wait-and-see moment, but I would not be surprised.
Meredith Blake covers television for the Los Angeles Times. Meredith, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Comic book superheroes generally know no boundaries. They might fly into space or visit the bottom of the ocean, but a boundary they don't usually cross is religion. That's about to change. Marvel is coming out with a very different kind of superhero. First of all, she's a she, and she's Muslim. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has the details.
Identity is a central issue for the comic heroine called Ms. Marvel, so says the author G. Willow Wilson.
Marvel is Kamala Khan, a young Pakistani-American teenager living in Jersey City who literally wakes up with superpowers and then has to figure out why she has them and how that fits into her day-to-day life.
Her superpower is the ability to shapeshift, even taking on different identities. Marvel editor Sana Amanat didn't read superhero comics growing up, so she wanted to create something that Muslim girls like herself could relate to. But the character is designed to appeal to a broader market, too.
For the little girls out there who feel like they're outsiders and they don't feel like they fit in.
In the past, female consumers haven't fit in the male-centric world of comic books. The industry mostly caters to young white boys. So there is risk in diversifying, but Marvel might just boost its audience and profits too. Albert Ching is senior editor of comicbookresources.com, which covers the comic book industry. He says Ms. Marvel has done well in reaching out to people who aren't normally comic book fans.
Already it's getting a lot of buzz. I mean, I've seen people sharing items about it on Facebook and Twitter who I wouldn't normally expect to think about comic books at all.
A successful comic book will sell around 100,000 copies per month. We'll have to wait until the Ms. Marvel debut in February to say whether she's got superpowers at the cash register. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which I will preface by observing that 9 years ago, according to the New York Times, there were 9,000 Blockbuster retail outlets around the country. After an announcement today from Dish Network, which bought Blockbuster out of bankruptcy 2 years ago, there will be just 50 stores, all of them third-party franchise operations. Dish is going to shut down all the stores it's still got running over the next couple of months. It's about 300 stores. 2,800 jobs will go away. And I'm going to date myself here, but do you remember when Blockbuster and really any video rental chain was so popular that you used to be able to buy videotape rewinding machines as gifts and give them away? Be kind. Please rewind. Anybody remember that? All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM. Ravi Karman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineer the broadcast for us. Thanks today to the staff here at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you back home in L.A. tomorrow. This is APM.